7 in 1941 to 871 in 1960, and prisoners' petitions in the Supreme Court were increasing even more rapidly. The federal habeas corpus jurisdiction was especially irritating to federal-state relations because the states disliked having constitutional issues retried after a prisoner had gone all through the state appellate process. And many, perhaps most of these prisoners' cases, arose because there had been no counsel at trial. Overruling Betts v. Brady would sharply decrease the volume of cases and reduce the federal-state conflict inherent in the federal habeas corpus remedy. As late as Thanksgiving, Jacob expected a substantial number of states, perhaps as many as 7, to join in an amicus brief on Florida's side of the case. The hope was based on the somewhat vague letters sent by their attorneys general. As it turned out, only 2 states spoke up for Florida, Alabama and North Carolina. "I never knew what happened to the others," Jacob said later. This amicus brief was written by George D. Mentz, Assistant Attorney General of Alabama, who had argued one right to counsel case in the Supreme Court. It made a strong appeal for federalism and states' rights. "It is the essence of our federalism," the brief said, "that states should have the widest latitude in the administration of their own systems of criminal justice. Someday, when finally the millennium is reached, all criminal defendants will have lawyers, and the poor will all be saved the pangs of hunger or the discomforts occasioned by a lack of adequate clothing, suitable housing, or other creature comforts. Those are humanitarian principles, but they are not imposed on the states by the 14th Amendment. If and when, in the considered judgment of the people of the individual states, such gratuitous services or aid are warranted morally or are feasible financially, they will be provided. Though man's social evolution is slow, history proves that he does advance in all fields. To be lasting, however, his progress must result from his own volition, rather than come from judicial fiat." On the counsel issue more specifically, Mentz's brief went on, "Alabama lawyers at a recent meeting agreed that an indigent without counsel stands a better chance of obtaining from a jury either an outright acquittal or less severe punishment than one represented by an attorney. Only a few lawyers would, in any case, be equal matches for career prosecutors. In this very trial, the record shows that Gideon presented the available defense about as ably as an average lawyer could have done. A universal counsel requirement might be an unbearably onerous financial burden for poorer counties if they had to pay assigned counsel. Furthermore, it is not an uncommon situation in thinly populated rural counties for there to be more persons charged with crime than there are lawyers versed in criminal practice, and some judges may encounter real difficulty in appointing enough qualified lawyers to serve at their criminal terms of court." Mentz, had he known, might have told the Supreme Court that there were only 77 practicing lawyers in the 6 counties of the Florida Judicial Circuit where Gideon was tried. The brief concluded, "Even with its exposure to occasional abuses, the rule of Betts v. Brady remains the best one for our American way of life. Any decision to make mandatory the appointment of counsel for all indigents charged with crime in state courts should come not from this court, but from the people of the individual states, acting through their elected legislatures or judges." That left only Florida's brief to be filed. Jacob had worked on it during the summer, but only sporadically, because too many other things were happening. Just after his return from National Guard camp in June, he had been interviewed by a law firm in Bartow, Florida, Holland, Beavis, and Smith. Holland is United States Senator Spessard L. Holland. Jacob was offered a position in the firm and agreed to take it, beginning in October. He thought the briefs in the Gideon case would all be filed by then, and he got Attorney General Irvin's permission to carry on with the oral argument of the case after leaving the office. But he had not anticipated the conflict with Fortas over what should go into the printed record. The time for filing of briefs does not begin to run until the record is printed, and the delay over that issue pushed everything back about 3 months. As a result, Jacob wrote Florida's brief after leaving the Attorney General's staff. By the time he began to write it, in the late fall, Jacob had lost the few shreds of hope he had had of winning the case. The episode of the record had not been encouraging. Jacob had not even known that a transcript of Gideon's trial had been prepared and supplied to the Supreme Court until he received Fortas's designation of materials to go into the record. Then he asked around the Attorney General's office and was told by old-timers that the same thing had happened, use of a trial transcript in a habeas corpus case where it was not formally at issue in a Florida case taken to the Supreme Court in 1940. That case was Chambers v. Florida, a landmark in the career of Hugo L. Black as a justice because he had been denounced, when appointed, as a racist. Four young Negroes had been convicted of murder on the basis of confessions they claimed had been coerced from them. Justice Black, after what one informed commentator has called great internal struggles, wrote an opinion for the court reversing the convictions on the ground that the prisoners had been forced to confess. "Under our constitutional system," he wrote, "courts stand against any winds that blow as havens of refuge for those who might otherwise suffer because they are helpless, weak, outnumbered, or because they are non-conforming victims of prejudice and public excitement." More discouraging to Jacob than loss of the small struggle over getting the trial transcript into the record was the retirement, on August 29th, of Justice Felix Frankfurter. More than any member of the Supreme Court, Justice Frankfurter stood for a belief in federalism, in the right of the states to be free from too limiting national restraints. In the early years after Betts v. Brady, Justice Frankfurter had been one of the strongest supporters of its flexible counsel doctrine. In more recent years, he had gone along silently with decisions requiring counsel in particular cases, but not with any suggestion of abandoning Betts. Not only his vote, but his leadership on the court seemed to Jacob, and to others, essential to any hope of preserving that doctrine. President Kennedy replaced Justice Frankfurter on the bench with Arthur J. Goldberg, the Secretary of Labor, whose training and experience in a different era made it doubtful at best that he would share his predecessor's emphasis on state independence. "I had been developing some hope that the court would draw back from this ultimate legislating," Jacob said later. "When Justice Frankfurter retired, I realized that we had very little chance." On September 8th, Jacob married Anne Ware, the girl he had been courting in the state capital. They had a week's honeymoon in Jamaica. Shortly afterward, they set up their new household in Bartow, and Jacob began practice at Holland, Beavis & Smith. The firm told him to take all the time he needed on the Gideon case, but he felt like I shouldn't do that. So he did the work, with clerical help from Anne, on nights and weekends. Research was a problem because there was so little material available in Bartow, which is a prosperous town but has a population of only 13,000 and a limited law library. Just about every weekend, Jacob and his wife drove the 250 miles to Tallahassee. He had a key to the library of the Florida Supreme Court, and there they would work, sometimes all night long. He read cases and other material, underlining things he thought important, and then Anne would copy them. Sometimes, instead of Tallahassee, they went to the Stetson Law School Library in St. Petersburg, which was only 60 miles or so from Bartow. When Jacob finally got around to drafting the brief in late November, he worked at home in the evening. The next day, Anne would type up what he had written. The last few days, as the deadline approached, he was forced to take some office time to finish up. Just before Christmas, he sent the brief off to the Attorney General's office in Tallahassee to be printed. There, final printing arrangements were handled by A.G. Spicola, Jr. But no changes were made in the substance of the brief. It remained a one-man product, written under circumstances that could hardly have been in more striking contrast to the time and talent expended on Gideon's side of the case. The brief, covering 74 pages, began with a section arguing that Gideon was not entitled to counsel under existing law, the rule of Betts v. Brady. Jacob reviewed the cases that had followed Betts in requiring a showing of special circumstances to obtain counsel. Gideon, he said, had made no affirmative showing of any circumstances of unfairness which would have entitled him to counsel under the 14th Amendment. He had said nothing about his age, experience, mental capacity, familiarity or unfamiliarity with court procedure, or the complexity of the legal issues presented by the charge. Jacob held to the position that the transcript of Gideon's trial was not properly before the Supreme Court, but if it were considered, he said, it proved that Gideon had had a fair trial. He took an active role in his defense and showed that he possessed much skill and facility in questioning witnesses. And beyond the trial transcript, Gideon's prison record showed that he was 50 when arrested, had finished the 8th grade, and had been convicted of 4 felonies, indicating, in the words of Justice Roberts about Betts, that he was not wholly unfamiliar with criminal procedure. Jacob had also obtained a letter from the judge who had tried the case, Robert L. McCrary, Jr., saying it was his opinion that Gideon had both the mental capacity and the experience in the courtroom at previous trials to adequately conduct his defense. This was later borne out at the trial. In my opinion, he did as well as most lawyers could have done in handling his case. Jacob did not mention this letter in his brief, but sent a copy to the Supreme Court, where it went into the Gideon file. The second and more substantial section of the brief argued that Betts v. Brady should not be overruled or modified. It was under 8 subheadings and can be summarized as follows. First, there is no historical basis for requiring states to automatically appoint counsel in all cases. Historically, the 6th Amendment was designed to overcome the English common law rule forbidding the retention of counsel in felony cases. Second, our federal system counsels against such a requirement. The 14th Amendment does not impose upon the states any uniform code of criminal procedure. Holmes had warned against use of the 14th Amendment to prevent the making of social experiments in the insulated chambers afforded by the several states. If the court now adopts an inflexible rule requiring automatic appointment in every case, it would defeat the very desirable possibility of state experiment in the field of criminal procedure. States would be prevented from adopting novel forms of procedure, whether fair or unfair. Third, the flexible test of requiring counsel only to assure a fair trial is consistent with the concept of due process of law. The Due Process Clause is a broad, inexplicit provision, and it is not susceptible of being reduced to a mechanical or fixed formula. Fourth, the Betts v. Brady rule provides a clear and consistent standard for determination of the right to counsel. The cases indicate 10 factors that should be considered, such as the prisoner's illiteracy or youth. The attempt in Fortas's brief, which of course Jacob had studied, to show that there were inconsistencies in the cases decided under the Betts rule proves nothing, because the common law is full of inconsistency. The Betts approach is the common law approach, consisting of the development of a body of law on a case-by-case basis, and lawyers for centuries have thrived in distinguishing one case from another on the basis of factual situations and circumstances. Fifth, many states require appointment of counsel, but the rules vary, and so the right cannot be called fundamental. A separate appendix listed the counsel rules of the 50 states, less comprehensively than Professor Kamisar's survey. Sixth, absorption of the 6th Amendment counsel guarantee into the 14th would have grave consequences. It would be impossible to draw the line at felonies. Misdemeanors would have to be included too. The result would be an enormous burden on members of the bar. Also, such an imposition would encourage those charged with misdemeanors to plead not guilty, and consequently more time would be consumed in the trial of minor cases. The entire undertaking would result in unnecessary expense to taxpayers. Moreover, counsel should logically be required in civil as well as criminal cases. It has been argued that overruling Betts would cut down the flood of litigation concerning the right to counsel, but that is unrealistic. The overruling would itself create myriad and complex new legal questions. Seventh, Appointment of counsel for the poor in all cases should not be required by the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. If that clause is read to forbid distinction between rich and poor in the courts, then the states would have to provide counsel for the poor not only at trial but on appeal, and would logically be required to provide an indigent with bail, with the services of investigators, psychiatrists, etc., since those things are available to the rich man. Eighth, the practical implications require adherence to Betts v. Brady. A survey of the Florida prisons shows that approximately 5,093 of the 7,836 prisoners in custody were not represented by counsel when tried. If Betts should be overruled by this court in the instant case, as many as 5,093 hardened criminals may be eligible to be released in one mass exodus in Florida alone, not to mention those in other states. Jacob ended with a cautionary plea. If this court should decide to overrule Betts, he said, respondent respectfully requests that it be accomplished in such way as to prevent the new rule from operating retrospectively. In other words, the newly defined right to counsel should not apply to persons already in prison, presumably including Clarence Earl Gideon. Even before he finished the brief, Jacob heard from the Supreme Court about the oral argument of the case. A letter received from Chief Deputy Clerk Cullinan on December 17th said Gideon v. Cochran would be reached for argument on Monday, January 14th, 1963. Chapter 11. Only a small part of the process of decision in the Supreme Court is exposed to public view, and of that portion by far the most interesting and the most revealing is oral argument. Even the citizen wholly unfamiliar with the court can gain some sense of the institution by sitting in the back of the chamber and listening to an argument. The exhaustive probing of a single set of facts shows, if it is done well, how our adversary system of justice can make truth emerge from conflict. It shows also how close the questions are that the Supreme Court must answer. Characteristically, the listener finds himself persuaded by the last voice he has heard. The comments from the bench, sometimes funny, sometimes quite blunt, bring out the personalities of the justices and remind us that the court is a collection of strong-minded individuals, much less institutionalized than the typical agency of the executive branch. Oral argument is more important in the court's decisional process than many lawyers realize. Too often they seem to regard it as a ceremonial affair, serving only to put a gloss on the contentions so carefully made in their briefs. But the court does not feel that way. The justices who have spoken on the subject, and many have, say that oral argument performs a distinct function, in some ways more influential than that of the briefs. A good argument, Justice Harlan said, may in many cases make the difference between winning and losing, no matter how good the briefs are. There are two reasons for this. One is that a brief cannot answer back when a justice reading it expresses doubt about some line of reasoning. Oral argument presents a great opportunity to answer the doubts and questions raised from the bench, to mollify one's critics and arm one's friends. This opportunity is the greater because of the Supreme Court tradition that oral argument is not an exhibition of high school oratory, but an exchange between counsel and court. The rules state that the court looks with disfavor on any oral argument that is read from a prepared text. It is a time for argument, not declamation. Justice Frankfurter once said that the court saw itself not as a dozing audience for the reading of soliloquies, but as a questioning body, utilizing oral argument as a means for exposing the difficulties of a case with a view to meeting them. And so, there are likely to be a great many questions from the bench. Unfortunately, some lawyers, not excluding well-known names of the Wall Street firms, seem to resent them, seeing questions as an intrusion on their well-ordered schemes of argument rather than as invitations to persuade. Justice Jackson, who was one of the great oral advocates of his day before he went on the bench, said in his wonderfully astringent style that he felt, "There should be some comfort derived from any question from the bench. it is clear proof that the inquiring justice is not asleep. If the question is relevant, it denotes he is grappling with your contention, even though he has not grasped it. It gives you opportunity to inflate his ego by letting him think he has discovered an idea for himself. The second reason for the importance of oral argument is the place it has in the timetable of the decisional process. The justices customarily take a tentative vote at their Friday conference on all the cases argued that week. The argument is likely to be fresh in their minds. Most members of the court, Justice Jackson said, form at least a tentative conclusion from it in a large percentage of the cases. Moreover, a lawyer who at argument succeeds in arousing a strongly favorable interest on the part of even one justice thereby obtains for his cause a spokesman in the privacy of the conference room. Given the significance of argument, its potential is realized far too infrequently. Many, probably most arguments in the Supreme Court, are dreary affairs. Counsel are often ill at ease, ill-prepared, or, worse yet, overconfident. One of the worst sins is to brush off questions or answer them less than candidly. On the other hand, Justice Holmes once complimented a lawyer on his candor, and then, as the gentleman was preening himself, remarked, "You know, candor is one of the most effective instruments in deception." Another mistake is to take the lofty approach, arguing only large abstractions. Such tactics inevitably produce glazed expressions on the bench. The justices seem more interested when a lawyer sticks to homely, factual arguments. Often in their questions, the members of the court try to find out what the case means in human terms, as if in their ivory tower they were lonesome for the real world. Justice Jackson had a slightly different explanation for the court's fascination with the facts at arguments. "The purpose of a hearing is that the court may learn what it does not know," he said, "and it knows least about the facts. It may sound paradoxical, but most contentions of law are won or lost on the facts. They often incline a judge to one side or the other." It is said, correctly, that no oral presentation, however effective, is likely to be able to change the deep-rooted philosophical positions that a justice inevitably comes to hold after some years on the bench. But there are ways of getting around those entrenchments, of suggesting narrow grounds, which the court almost always prefers, for a decision in favor of one's client. There are also ways of alienating votes that should be favorable. Probably more cases are lost than won by argument. The mediocre level of argument in the Supreme Court reflects the lack of a strong tradition of oral advocacy in this country. In England, by contrast, the appellate process is almost entirely an oral presentation. There are no briefs. Counsel read out the relevant portions of the lower court record and then discuss the legal questions, without fixed time limits, until their lordships indicate that they have heard enough. A successful barrister is by definition an effective oral advocate. But in this country, many of the most prosperous lawyers never see the inside of a courtroom, and legal training emphasizes written work rather than oral presentation. Our system was once much more like the British. There was a distinctive Supreme Court bar, whose members, such men as Daniel Webster, appeared regularly before the court. It was not unusual, moreover, for Webster to go on for days. But those spacious times are gone. The only lawyers who appear in the Supreme Court with any regularity are the Solicitor General and the members of his small staff, who argue most of the federal government cases. Many arguments are made by lawyers who will appear in the Supreme Court only once in their lives. When they get that chance, few are about to delegate the argument to some modern-day Webster. Experience is not all. Little-known lawyers from far corners of the country occasionally make superior arguments, the better for their freshness of approach. And time for argument is now rigorously limited. Chief Justice Hughes was said by one of his law clerks to have called time on a leader of the New York bar in the middle of the word if. Ordinarily, the court allows either an hour or a half hour to each side of a case. In the Gideon case, each party had an hour, and the court had taken the unusual step of granting an additional half-hour for oral argument by a friend of the court on each side. Former Solicitor General Rankin, on behalf of the American Civil Liberties Union, for Gideon, and Assistant Attorney General Mentz of Alabama, for Florida. The argument presented no novel challenge to Abe Fortas, a man of experience and reputation in the Supreme Court. But to Bruce Jacob, who had never even seen the courtroom before, the prospect was unnerving. He flew to Washington on Saturday, January 12th, 2 days before the clerk's office had indicated the case would be reached. The flight was bumpy, doing nothing to improve Jacob's already queasy stomach. He spent the weekend in the hotel trying to anticipate questions he might be asked, worrying over his argument outline, worrying in general. Early on Monday morning, he had another minor concern to dispose of: to arrange his admission to the Supreme Court bar. Anyone is eligible after 3 years in the bar of his state's highest court. Membership qualifies one to file briefs and argue in the Supreme Court. Jacob barely met the 3-year requirement, but under the usual practice, he would have been admitted pro hoc vicee for this one occasion only to make his argument. About 2,500 lawyers a year pay the $25 fee to become members of the Supreme Court bar, most of them presumably so that they can frame the parchment certificate and hang it in their offices. The court uses the money to pay the expenses of indigents such as Gideon. Each applicant must be presented for admission, in open court, by a lawyer already a member of the court's bar, and this rule caused Jacob some unnecessary worry. Senator Holland of Florida had arranged to have former Solicitor General Rankin move Jacob's admission. Jacob was afraid it would be embarrassing to have the favor done by one of his adversaries, an excessive sensitivity on his part, and he got George Mentz of Alabama to present him instead. As he entered the Supreme Court building that Monday morning, and then for the first time watched the justices at work, Bruce Jacob experienced the confusing change of emotions that any sensitive person feels in that curious place. For the court is a place of contrasts, of paradoxes. It is grandiose and intimate, ritualistic and informal, austere and human, at the same time the most aloof and the most approachable of all the institutions of government. Grandiose is the word for the physical setting. The WPA Guide to Washington called the Supreme Court building a great marble temple, which, by its august scale and mighty splendor, seems to bear little relation to the functional purposes of government. Shortly before the justices moved into the building in 1935, from their old chamber across the street in the Capitol, Justice Stone wrote his sons, "The place is almost bombastically pretentious, and thus it seems to me wholly inappropriate for a quiet group of old boys such as the Supreme Court." He told his friends that the justices would be 9 black beetles in the Temple of Karnak. The visitor who climbs the marble steps and passes through the marble columns of the huge pseudo-classical facade finds himself in a cold, lofty hall, again all marble. Great bronze gates exclude him from the area of the building where the justices work in private, their offices, library, and conference room. In the courtroom, which is always open to the public, the atmosphere of austere pomp is continued. There are more columns, an enormously high ceiling, red velvet hangings, friezes carved high on the walls. The ritual opening of each day's session adds to the feeling of awe. The court crier to the right of the bench smashes his gavel down sharply on a wooden block. Everyone rises, and the justices file in through the red draperies behind the bench and stand at their places as the crier intones the traditional opening. "The Honorable, the Chief Justice, and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court." But then, when an argument begins, all the trappings and ceremony seem to fade, and the scene takes on an extraordinary intimacy. In the most informal way, altogether without pomp, court and counsel converse. It is conversation, as direct, unpretentious, and focused discussion as can be found anywhere in Washington. "It was nothing like I expected," Bruce Jacobs said later. "It was so informal, I just couldn't believe it. Usually judges are so sober-looking, they don't laugh. Not that they're inhuman, but they're nothing like Supreme Court justices. I just got the impression that these men had a real good time, talking to each other and asking questions." The case of Gideon V. Cochran was not reached that day. Chief Deputy Cullinan always has counsel in court earlier than necessary, so that there is no chance of a case ending early and no other being ready for the justices. There is no exact time for each case to start. The court simply sits for argument from 10 a.m. to 2:30 p.m., with 12 to 12:30 out for lunch, Monday through Thursday, and when one case is finished, the next is called. Because this was a Monday, arguments were delayed for the reading of opinions. Then, at noon, there was a special interruption because the justices had to be at the Capitol to hear President Kennedy read his State of the Union message. Later that afternoon and the next morning, counsel in the Gideon case sat and listened with at least half an ear to the argument of an important antitrust case by two able advocates, Solicitor General Archibald Cox and Gerhard A. Gissell of Washington. They concluded at 11:06 Tuesday morning. Chief Justice Warren, as is the custom, called the next case by reading aloud its full title. Number 155, Clarence Earl Gideon, Petitioner, versus H.G. Cochran, Jr., Director, Division of Corrections, State of Florida. From his desk at the left of the bench, the clerk of the court, John F. Davis, said, "Counsel are present," and the lawyers in the Gideon case moved forward to two long tables just below the bench. The justices are seated in an order fixed by tradition. At the far right, as seen by the spectators, was the newest member of the court, Arthur J. Goldberg of Illinois, 54 years old, the gray-haired labor lawyer who had made such a dynamic Secretary of Labor before President Kennedy appointed him to the bench. At the far left was the other Kennedy appointee, Byron R. White of Colorado, 45, physically powerful but scholarly in appearance, as befits an all-American football hero who was also a Rhodes Scholar. Next to Justice Goldberg was Potter Stewart of Ohio, 47 but still collegiate in his good looks, whom President Eisenhower made a Court of Appeals judge and then raised to the Supreme Court in 1958. Second from the left was the smallish, brisk figure of William J. Brennan, Jr., 56, a New Jersey Supreme Court justice who was a surprise Eisenhower appointee, because he was a Democrat, in 1956. He is the only Roman Catholic on the court. On the right, again, was John Marshall Harlan, 63, a Wall Street lawyer picked by Eisenhower for the Court of Appeals and advanced to the Supreme Court in 1955, looking perhaps more like a judge than anyone else, appropriately enough for the grandson and namesake of an earlier Supreme Court justice. Third from the left was Tom C. Clark, also 63, a friendly Texan, former Attorney General, the only Truman appointee, 1949, still on the court. To the right of the Chief Justice was William O. Douglas, 64, a ruddy-faced outdoorsman from the state of Washington, a law school professor and New Deal official appointed by Franklin Roosevelt in 1939. On the other side of the Chief was Hugo L. Black, 76 years old, but still a tough competitor at tennis, hawk-nosed, with the soft sound of rural Alabama in his voice. A senator when Roosevelt put him on the court in 1937. Finally, at the center, sat Earl Warren, 71, a county law officer for 20 years, Attorney General of California for 4, an immensely popular governor for 10, Republican candidate for vice president in 1948. A huge, white-haired figure, named Chief Justice by Eisenhower in 1953. The lawyer arguing a case stands at a small rostrum between the two counsel tables facing the Chief Justice. The party that lost in the lower court goes first, and so the argument in Gideon v. Cochran was begun by Abe Fortas. As he stood, the Chief Justice gave him the customary greeting. "Mr. Fortas," and he made the customary opening. "Mr. Chief Justice, May it please the court. This case presents a narrow question, Fortas said, the right to counsel, unencumbered by extraneous issues. The charge was a felony, not any lesser offense. Gideon's indigence was conceded. He had unquestionably made a timely request for counsel, and the demand was for a lawyer at his trial, not at any earlier and hence more doubtful point in the criminal proceeding. Fortas began reciting the facts. In his deep, deliberate, somewhat mournful voice, occasionally removing his horn-rimmed glasses and gesturing with them for emphasis, he told the justices about the morning Clarence Earl Gideon was supposed to have broken into the Bay Harbor pool room and stolen some wine, perhaps some cigarettes, and an unstated amount of money. Fortas described Gideon's active participation in his own trial, his attempts to cross-examine and address the jury. Then, on this brief foundation of the facts, he began to build his legal argument. This record does not indicate that Clarence Earl Gideon was a person of low intelligence, Fortas said, or that the judge was unfair to him. But to me, this case shows the basic difficulty with Betts versus Brady. It shows that no man, however intelligent, can conduct his own defense adequately. At this point, Justice Harlan intervened. He was the court's most convinced believer in the value of state independence, and Fortas had anticipated the greatest difficulty in persuading him to overrule Betts. "That's not the point, is it, Mr. Fortas?" Justice Harlan asked. "Betts didn't go on the assumption that a man can do as well without an attorney as he can with one, did it? Everyone knows that isn't so." In fact, it could be fairly argued that Justice Roberts, in Betts, had gone on exactly that assumption. He certainly had said that that particular trial was so simple that there would have been little for a lawyer to do. But Fortas, instead of challenging Justice Harlan's proposition, accepted it for the implicit concession it was, and used it to drive on to his point about federalism. "I entirely agree, Mr. Justice Harlan, with the point you are making, namely, that of course a man cannot have a fair trial without a lawyer, but Betts held that this consideration was outweighed by the demands of federalism. My purpose was to show that this case is not Tweedledum and Tweedledee with one tried by counsel. I believe this case dramatically illustrates that you cannot have a fair trial without counsel. Under our adversary system of justice, how can our civilized nation pretend that there is a fair trial without the counsel for the prosecution doing all he can within the limits of decency, and the counsel for the defense doing his best within the same limits, and from that clash will emerge the truth? I think there is a tendency to forget what happens to these poor, miserable, indigent people in these strange and awesome circumstances. Sometimes, in this court, there is a tendency to forget what happens downstairs. I was reminded the other night, as I was pondering this case, of Clarence Darrow when he was prosecuted for trying to fix a jury. The first thing he realized was that he needed a lawyer. He, one of the country's great criminal lawyers. And so the real basis of Betts against Brady must be the understanding sensitivity of this court to the pull of federalism. This last statement of Fortas's seemed, for some not readily understandable reason, to anger Justice Harlan. This usually gentle man, visibly reddened, leaned forward and said very sharply, "Really, Mr. Fortas, understanding sensitivity seems to me a most unfortunate term to describe one of the fundamental principles of our constitutional system." "Mr. Justice Harlan," Fortas replied without a flicker of emotion, "I believe in federalism. It is a fundamental principle for which I personally have the highest regard and concern, and which I feel must be reconciled with the result I advocate. But I believe that Betts against Brady does not incorporate a proper regard for federalism. It requires a case-by-case supervision by this court of state criminal proceedings, and that cannot be wholesome. Intervention should be in the least abrasive, the least corrosive way possible." That was the argument that Fortas considered central to his case. He had expected to make it later in his presentation, after more of a build-up, but Justice Harlan's question had given him the opportunity to make the point dramatically. As a skillful advocate, he had abandoned his earlier outline and made the thrust at once. Whether the answer satisfied Justice Harlan was a question only the justice could answer, but he did lean back and appear somewhat happier. Fortas traced the history of the right to counsel in the Supreme Court, beginning with the Scottsboro case, Powell v. Alabama, in 1932. He described the Betts Doctrine and the subsequent cases in which the court had or had not found the special circumstances requiring counsel. "I have read all the cases now," he said, "state and federal, and it is a fascinating inquiry. As I read the opinions of this court, I hope I may be forgiven for saying that my heart was full of compassion for the judges having to review those records and look for special circumstances." Justice Stewart: "When was the last time we did not find special circumstances? I think there have been none in my 4 1/2 terms on the court." Fortas: "I think it was Quicksall in Michigan in 1950. Of course this, the special circumstances approach, is wrong. How can a judge, when a man is arraigned, look at him and say there are special circumstances? Does the judge say, 'You look stupid,' or 'Your case involves complicated facts'? It is administratively unworkable." Justice Harlan: "The states are recognizing that." Fortas took up that point and outlined the situation in the states. He used Professor Kamisar's figures. 37 states now provided counsel for the poor in all felony trials. 8 others frequently did so as a matter of practice. 5 made no regular provision for counsel, except in capital cases. But he did not agree with any implication in Justice Harlan's question that the movement by the states to act themselves argued against a step forward now by the Supreme Court. He noted the brief amicus curiae for 23 states in favor of overruling Betts, and said he was proud of this document as an American. Then he argued that the growing acceptance of the right to counsel made a reinterpretation of the Constitution easier. "I believe we can confidently say that overruling Betts versus Brady at this time would be in accord with the opinion of those entitled to an opinion. That is not always true of great constitutional questions. We may be comforted in this constitutional moment by the fact that what we are doing is a deliberate change after 20 years of experience, a change that has the overwhelming support of the bench, the bar, and even of the states." Justice Goldberg raised the problem of the limits on what Fortas was asking. At what stage of a criminal case must a lawyer be supplied? In what kinds of cases?
"Do we have to pass on that?" Justice Clark interjected.
"No, sir, not at this time," Fortas said, but he went on to give his own opinion anyway. "A lawyer should be provided at least from the first arraignment of the prisoner before a magistrate, through his trial and appeal, and the right should apply in all save petty offenses." Justice Stewart thought the definition of petty offenses might produce difficulties, might be more of this ad hoc judging you're trying to get away from. What about traffic violations? Fortas said he personally saw no difficulty in providing lawyers even for traffic offenders who wanted them. He knew that sounded strange, but it would work. Only an occasional oddball would ask, and it would be easy to say to him, "Yes, sir, go right down the hall to that door. That's the public defender's office. They'll see you." It was noon by this time, and the court rose for lunch. Afterwards, Fortas hoped to say just a few words more, then reserve about 10 minutes of his time for a rebuttal, as the opening counsel is allowed to do. But he was still being questioned when the marshal of the court, sitting to the right of the bench, threw the switch for the small white light on the lectern that indicates counsel has only 5 minutes left. And the questions continued. Justice Stewart asked whether he was right in his impression that Fortas was not arguing the old proposition that the 14th Amendment had incorporated the 6th Amendment as such. Fortas agreed he was not. But the answer that pleases one justice may arouse another,
and this one aroused the member of the court who had been arguing for a generation that the 14th Amendment incorporated the entire original Bill of Rights, Justice Black. He asked in a puzzled way why Fortas was laying aside that argument. "Mr. Justice Black," Fortas replied, "I like that argument that you have made so eloquently, but I cannot as an advocate make that argument because this court has rejected it so many times. I hope you never cease making it." Justice Black joined in the general laughter. "You are saying," Justice Brennan said helpfully to Fortas, "that the right to counsel is assured by the 14th Amendment, whether by absorption, incorporation, or whatever." "Mr. Justice," said Fortas, "you seem to know me well." At that, the red light on the lectern went on, meaning that Fortas's hour was up. But as he sat down, the Chief Justice gave him an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal, adding the same to Jacob's time on the other side. Next came Rankin's appearance as a friend of the court. As he had when he was Solicitor General, he spoke softly, in homely phrases, and with an air of deep sincerity. "Judges have a special responsibility here," Rankin began, "and so do lawyers. It just isn't true that laymen know these rules of law, the sophisticated concepts of criminal law. That's what's wrong with Betts. It is time, long past time, that our profession stood up and said, 'We know a man cannot get a fair trial when he represents himself.' It is enough of a fiction to claim that an ordinary lawyer can present a case as well as the prosecutor with all his experience in court. But when you take a layman and put him at odds, you can't have a fair trial, except by accident." Thus Rankin, appropriately for his role, was focusing less on Gideon the individual and more on the broad problem from the viewpoint of the legal profession. Justice Harlan accused him of making too sweeping generalizations about the impossibility of fair trial without counsel. Rankin agreed that it was not absolutely impossible to be tried fairly without a lawyer's help, but he said Betts had the generalization backward. It assumed that only in the special case did a man need a lawyer, while the truth was it was the rare case where one did not need counsel. Justice Goldberg: "If it's a generalization, the need for counsel, isn't there substantial support for it in the Constitution? The framers of the Sixth Amendment thought there should always be counsel." That was, historically, a doubtful proposition. Rankin: "That's what I think." Justice Stewart: "Isn't that generalization the assumption behind the legal profession? Florida wouldn't let Gideon, a non-lawyer, go into court and represent anyone else." Rankin ended by dismissing as unproved prediction the charge that overruling Betts would empty the jails. He said the court should apply the new doctrine assuring counsel retrospectively to past as well as future cases. Justice Harlan asked whether the court could constitutionally limit a decision to future operation. Rankin said he was doubtful. At 1:10 in the afternoon, Bruce Jacobs' turn came. Looking extremely young and earnest, he began by giving a little more description of Gideon, his age, 52, color, white, and previous felony convictions, 4. Then he complained about the inclusion of the trial transcript in the printed record. Justice Harlan: "Why do you bother about that?" Jacob: "Okay, I won't press it." Justice White: "You are not questioning our jurisdiction in this case." Jacob: "No, Your Honor." From then on, Jacob was deluged by questions. There was scarcely a consecutive 5-minute period when he could talk without interruption. Considering his unfamiliarity with the process and the unpopularity of his cause, he showed commendable stamina. Justice Black: "Why isn't it, Betts, as much interference with the states as an absolute rule? One of my reactions to Betts was the uncertainty in which it leaves the states." Jacob: "I don't think Betts is that unclear." Justice Black: "How do you know what the special circumstances are?" Jacob: "Each time this court decides a case, we know another special circumstance." Justice Brennan: "In recent years, in 4 cases, I think, we have reversed cases from your state every time." Jacob: We prefer case-by-case adjudication. It may not be precise, but we prefer it that way because it gives the state some freedom in devising its own rules of criminal procedure. Jacob, history argues against the drawing of inflexible lines, and this court has never laid down any fixed rules on the right to counsel.
Justice Brennan, what about Powell against Alabama? Doesn't that lay down a rule for capital cases?
Jacob, that was decided on the circumstances. Justice Harlan,
perhaps so, but subsequent cases have made clear that there is a fixed rule for capital cases. There is no point in your arguing that.
Justice Black,
what historical support have you found for the distinction between capital and non-capital cases?
Jacob, Your Honor, I can't think of any.
Justice Black, I can't either. That's why I asked.
Justice Stewart,
there is nothing in the language of the 14th Amendment, certainly, to make the distinction. It speaks of life, liberty, or property.
Jacob, there is a practical distinction between capital and non-capital cases if you want to draw the line somewhere. Everyone is fearful of being put to death.
Justice Black, maybe they're fearful of spending years in the penitentiary, too.
Jacob, by imposing an inflexible rule, we feel this court would be intruding into an area historically reserved to the states. It would stifle state experimentation. For example, a state might eliminate prosecutors as well as defense counsel and leave the whole trial to the judge.
Justice Harlan, don't go too far now.
Justice Stewart, repeating a point he had made to Rankin,
Gideon would not be allowed to represent others in court.
Jacob, if a defendant asked for him, I'm sure the judge wouldn't object.
Justice Black, the local bar association might.
Jacob, I'm sorry, Your Honor. That was a stupid answer. Jacob next talked about the consequences of overruling Betts v. Brady, grave consequences as he saw them. The new doctrine would necessarily extend to trivial cases, and the cost of providing counsel would be a tremendous burden on the taxpayers. The next thing one knew, indigents would also be demanding other free services, psychiatrists, expert witnesses, and so forth. In effect, this court would be requiring the states to adopt socialism or a welfare program. Finally, Jacob emphasized the 5,093 convicts now in Florida prisons who were tried without counsel and might now be eligible for release if Betts were overruled. If the court does reverse, we implore it to find some way not to make it retroactive. We have followed Betts in good faith. Chief Justice Warren wanted to know whether some of those 5,093 Florida convicts were illiterate. His point was plain and deadly. An illiterate defendant was entitled to counsel even under Betts v. Brady, since illiteracy qualified as a special circumstance. So the chances were that any illiterates among those 5,093 tried without counsel had been deprived of their constitutional rights. Because they lacked Clarence Earl Gideon's determination, or luck, they had not won redress in the courts.
I have no way of knowing, Jacob said to the Chief Justice.
No, but what do you think?
The Chief Justice pressed. Do you think most of them are literate or illiterate?
I don't know, but I am sure some of them are illiterate. Jacob concluded without using his extra 5 minutes, and then George Mentz of Alabama took over. He was an older man, gray-haired, more experienced than Jacob, and much more at ease. He was questioned just as frequently, but the questions seemed to give him less pain. He answered in a charming southern voice, making graceful concessions. I candidly admit, he began, that it would be desirable for the states to furnish counsel in all criminal cases. But we say the states should have the right to make that decision themselves.
Justice Harlan, supposing Betts is not overruled, how many years is it going to take Alabama to pass a law like New York and the other states?
Mentz, I don't know, but there is a growing feeling in the trial courts that something should be done.
Mentz, our judges are conscientious in protecting indigent defendants.
Justice Stewart, we can assume all of that with you, but a judge's job is to be a judge. This was he would be an advocate for one of the litigants.
Justice Goldberg. What about the vital matter of the final address to the jury? Surely a judge can't take over that job of advocacy.
Mentz. That is true, but prosecutors are more lenient with unrepresented defendants.
Justice Stewart. Isn't that a matter of trial strategy? It might backfire if the prosecutor were tough and the jury saw the defendant there helpless.
Mentz. Well, yes, sir.
Justice Stewart.
All you're saying is that the absence of counsel impedes the adversary system of justice.
Mentz.
I didn't mean to go that far.
Justice Stewart.
I'm sure you didn't.
Mentz.
In actuality, indigents without lawyers probably get off easier. The average Alabama lawyer is not equipped to deal with the career prosecutor. An articulate defendant may get his story across to the jury better.
Justice Black. That's not very complimentary to our profession.
Mentz, good-humoredly.
No, sir.
Justice Douglas.
Maybe if laymen are as effective as you say, we should get the Sixth Amendment repealed.
Mentz.
Mr. Justice, I didn't mean to go that far. I meant only that laymen are not at so great a disadvantage.
Justice Douglas. As some appellate judges think.
Justice Harlan.
Supposing you had a choice, as you see it, representing the state, of maintaining bets on the books and then having a succession of cases come to this court, every one of which was reversed by finding special circumstances, so that everyone would know we were only paying lip service to bets, or of overruling it.
Mentz. We'd rather see them decided case by case.
Justice Harlan.
Even though you know how all of them will come out.
Mentz. Hope springs eternal.
Laughter in the courtroom.
Then Fortas got up for his rebuttal. He said a word about Mapp v. Ohio, the case in which, 2 years before, the Supreme Court had reinterpreted the Constitution to bar the use of illegally seized evidence in state trials. To paraphrase Mr. Justice Clark's opinion there, time has set its face against Betts and Brady. He noted also Justice Clark's opinion in the second overseas court-martial cases, saying they removed any basis for a constitutional distinction between crimes subject to the death penalty and others.
I think Betts and Brady was wrong when it was decided,
Fortas said in his peroration.
I think time has made that clear, and I think time has now made it possible for the correct rule, the civilized rule, the rule of American constitutionalism, the rule of due process, to be stated by this court with limited disturbance to the states.
Justice Harlan had one more question. Had Mr. Fortas, in his research, found any errors in Justice Roberts' exposition of the history of the right to counsel in his opinion in Betts v. Brady? Clearly, Justice Harlan would find it much easier to overrule Betts if that decision could be shown to have been based on erroneous historical premises. But Fortas had no comfort to offer there. He replied, "We would have some differences, perhaps, but I don't say that the historical technique of constitutional interpretation will reach my result." In order to overrule Betts, then, Justice Harlan would have to look at the same problem that had faced Justice Roberts in 1942 and say that a different answer was required in 1963. As a believer in stare decisis, he would not find that easy to do. And yet he seemed to want to turn away from Betts v. Brady. The last word in the argument was Justice Harlan's, and it showed the struggle going on inside him.
"What one is left with," he said, "is getting one's hands on something that has happened in the last 20 years.
Chapter 12. The justices ordinarily take their first formal vote on the merits of a case at the Friday conference immediately following the oral argument. Within the next few days, the Chief Justice, if he is in the majority, sends a formal note assigning the opinion to one member of the court, or keeps it for himself. If the Chief is in the minority, the Senior Justice on the side that prevailed at conference assigns the opinion. The minority usually agrees about who will write the dissent. Notwithstanding such assignments, any member of the court is free to write his own concurring or dissenting opinion if he wishes, and they often do. Jefferson, who feared Chief Justice Marshall's persuasive power over his brethren, thought every member of the court should have to write his own opinion in every case. A few years ago, Justice Harlan, as he began a dissent that was the fourth opinion in the same case, said,